you can do whatever you want in the introduction. I don't really care.
Well, I didn't know if you were Richard Alpert or Ram Dass or...
I'm Ram Dass, who used to be Richard Alpert, PhD, psychologist. And I'm a spiritual seeker, student of spirit. What else do you want?
Well, I think I had some little direction here from my engineer. What did you say, Pia? Hold on. Oh, okay. She says to please try to be mindful of speaking directly into the phone rather than past it. Because I think that we have a kind of a little bit of a funny connection or something, and it just comes out better if you can
manage
to do that.
Okay, if you want to hold a minute, I'm going to go to another phone.
Oh, okay.
It'll be better.
All right, he's going to another phone.
Hold on for a second. Let's see if I can...
Okay. Well, he wants to go to another phone anyway.
Hello?
Hello, hi.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out
what you're doing right now is just fine. That's okay with us. Are you comfortable? If you are, then we're okay. I can't hear him anymore. I'm on hold, I think, is what it is.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Good. How's that, Pia? Is that good? Okay, we got the thumbs up here.
Is that better?
Yeah, I think it's better. How does it sound? Just speak again for one moment.
Yeah, speaking. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Sounded like it was better before, didn't it, Pia?
Back the other place?
If possible, yeah. And if you just speak right into the phone, that was the best of all that we've got so far.
Okay.
Sorry.
Oh, now it's going to be complicated. Just a
okay,
second.
Okay, exactly. All right.
Wait a minute. Memory. Story of the matter. Okay, hold on 1 second.
All right. You can stop tape, I guess.
Speaking right into the phone.
Great. Wonderful. All right. Groovy. We're off and running. I got three thumbs up from my unusual engineer here.
That's unusual.
Yeah, I know. She's great. So, okay, here we are. I'm doing this documentary, as I may have mentioned to you, about death as either imminent death or, you know, an explicit awareness of your ultimate death as being an opportunity to wake up spiritually. And I'd like to know what you can tell me about this, and perhaps we can relate it a little bit to some of the ideas in the How Can I Help book, because I'd also like to know how people who are with people who are dying can...
People what?
People who are with people who are dying, either caretakers or loved ones or whatever, can use this galvanizing episode and awareness to sort of get themselves to the next level, if they're interested.
Working with people that are dying has become the most fulfilling and spiritually challenging thing that I do in my life. And the reason is because that situation is one in which one can only bring that which is closest to one's truth. There's no way to bring less than that. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, that they have nothing to lose anymore. And they're out there. They're right there. And if you try to be clever or use a textbook situation to deal with it, you feel the hypocrisy of it in that space. And it pulls on you to listen carefully, to tune carefully to another human being, to listen to find out what metaphor is appropriate for the dialogue so that the space can be as open as possible. What I find my role is when I'm with people that are dying is to become an environment, a very spacious environment in which the person can do what they need to do. Because I realized a long time ago I have no moral right to decide how another person should die or have to have values about what's the best dying. Because each unique individual has their own karmic predicament, I guess I'd say.
What do you mean by karmic predicament? I happen to know what you mean, but our listeners may not. It's kind of a technical word.
Well, all it means is they have a set of predispositions. They have a set of ongoing things that are in their psyche that they're working with that are coming out of their past. And you can debate how far past that is, but there is a lot of stuff that will determine how they're going to react at this moment. I mean, if they've been very materialistic all their life in the sense of philosophical materialism, the fear of death is going to be very great because it feels like extinction. While if they have grown up in a cultural context in which there is a much broader sense of the mystery of life and that there is some continuity or something beyond death, they have a very different feeling and attitude towards dying. And I can be an environment where if they ask me, I'll share what I believe, but if they don't ask me, all I do is open my mind as far as possible so that, because what happens as a person is dying often is that they start to have available to them other planes of non-ordinary states of consciousness. And most of the time they are surrounded by people who treat those things as sort of pathology of some sort. The person's mind is wandering, I don't understand them anymore. They're being confused. Those are the words I hear, confused, like. And if you're spacious enough and liquid enough and not and ready to flow in and out of places, you can go with the person or listen in or tune to them and be with them in those spaces. And that's a very great gift. And it brings the two of you very close together. And I begin to see that the most profound experience of the dying process is the intimacy of two beings facing the mystery together.
And that in itself is sort of a healing notion.
It's a healing for both of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I come away feeling that if I didn't feel enriched and by it, something went wrong. Because both of us should feel that when one human heart meets another and we stand there in awe of the mystery, we have both been enriched immeasurably.
What is it about death that makes these kinds of alternate modes of consciousness or makes it more likely that they'll be able to really be there facing the mystery with another being? I mean, presumably these alternate realities are available to us even when we're jogging around, you know, doing triathlons or whatever.
They're available all the time, but usually because of efficiency, we rule them out or treat them as error or irrelevant. That kind of stuff in our consciousness. And what happens in the at certain stages in the dying process, the kind of will of I'm going to control everything starts to let go a little bit because you realize that this whatever this is, it's bigger than you are, and you can't control it. It's like a trauma of some deep sort to the ego. And when that happens, there is an opening. It's like a window opens. And that's a moment where the person, under the right conditions, can get in touch with the true spiritual source within their own being.
You mentioned opening before. I would like you to if possible, to talk a little bit about why your opening, what your opening is, and why that helps them. I mean, for example, if they're very angry or they're in denial or whatever, all these kind of jargon words that we throw around now.
Yeah.
But will your opening just enable them to...
My job is not to judge them, but to listen and to tune so that there are two things that happen. One is through empathy, they feel that that there is another human being out there hearing them. They feel heard. And that's an important part of it. And then the second part is I don't get trapped in the storyline, so that I'm also creating a space in which they are able to, if they want to come out and play, I'll be out here playing. If they don't want to, that's fine. And I know this sounds a little jargony, but what I'm dealing with is two planes of consciousness simultaneously. If I get too far out into la-la land, into just spacious awareness with no form, then they won't feel as a real human being there. And if I stay too caught in my empathic interpersonal world, I don't have the freedom to offer them escape from that. So they get angry, and I hear the anger, but I don't get reactive to the anger. I'm just holding the anger, and I'm hearing it and holding it. And then they have the freedom to hold on to it or not, but there's nothing in me that's reinforcing their being stuck with it.
I see. So their drama doesn't stick to you, and the cycle develops.
Exactly right. While most times with other people, if they get angry at you or get angry, you get reactive to their anger. And that just keeps the whole thing real.
Then you're off at the races.
Exactly.
Or whatever the expression
exactly.
is.
Exactly. And that's what mostly happens around dying people. Everybody's reacting because they're all, in the face of the mystery, they experience fear. And in fear, people get very reactive.
What do you mean by, I mean, this is probably a big question, but can you tell me what you mean by the mystery? I think I have sort of an intuitive sense, but
I would say that there are realms in our life, like why is there suffering in the world? Why do children suffer, for example? What is the nature of before birth? What happens after death? I would say these are things where we as separate entities with rational minds do not know. I'd say this is the mystery. And you can respond by giving an explanation of the mystery, but you'll find out that every explanation is sort of reductionistic. It's just a kind of an attempt to ward off the darkness by trying to know you know when you don't really know. So I find it more inviting to use the term mystery and with the term I don't know, and then help that become a familiar and comfortable place to be, rather than a feeling of failure. That I think we in the West, especially, have a feeling we have to know we know in order to control everything, in order to feel safe. And I find that when you say to somebody, somebody will ask me a question at a lecture or a workshop, and I'll say, I don't know. And I can feel that they didn't expect that. And I find that opens up the whole situation in a kind of a very fresh way. See, I just don't really know, but let's just be there together with our I don't know-ness. Because if you look at what all the models are after death, the Tibetans have one model, the Native Americans have another, the Christians have another. There's heaven and hell, or there's the Bardos, or there's on and on and on, the mansions. And I think these are all the conceptual mind trying to impose structure on something that is basically non-conceptual. I definitely, deeply, intuitively sense that we are part of larger systems than that which we define by the boundaries of birth and death. But I don't feel that my conceptual mind, my rational mind, which is a subsystem, can really describe that metasystem adequately.
What's the point? I mean, again, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but it seems that there's a level of the mystery around death and other similar kinds of mysteries, as you describe it, that is very attractive and very fascinating. I mean, one thing you can do if there's something you don't know the answer to is just say, well, the hell with it. I don't know the answer, so I'm just not even going to think about it or entertain it, or it's just not going to come into focus because I don't know the answer. But at the same time, it seems like you and people that you work with are drawn to this anyway. I wonder if you could address that.
Well, I think I'm drawn to it mainly because of the kind of inner work I've done over the last 35 years, in which I have been able, through a lot of my spiritual practices, to extricate my awareness from identification with my own thought and draw the awareness back into a quality of being that isn't in time or space, doesn't have much to do with birth and death. And the intuitive validity of that state of awareness colors my life, because I see that as I look around me, I see how much the denial of something as profound in one's life as that, because dying is really, it's a major ritual. And to say, I'm not going to think about it, is denial, and the cost of denial is not cheap. There is a cost to that denial.
What is the cost?
The cost is that you're off balance because you're always pushing away something. It's something we won't look at. And I think that as you get deeper into the deeper parts of your own being, you realize that present in that are all of the different mysteries and emotions and states. Like a lot of people say, I want to be happy today. Let's not talk about that. Let's not think about that. And I would say if there's something you are not thinking about, you're pushing away, that what is happening is it's what Freud would call cathecting libido. It's taking energy and blocking that energy, and you don't have it to play with because you're busy not thinking about something. And I think my own life experience is that when I'm fully in the moment, I haven't pushed anything away. I can be joyful and at the same moment hold the realization of the immense amount of suffering that's going on in the world everywhere. And some people say, well, that's depressing. Well, it's only depressing if you don't have the balance of all of the beauty that's happening. And if you can hold that all at once in your being, I think there is the richness of the moment, which is a true spiritual connection. And I think that's what happens when you die, is that all of it is present. It's not like it's not as impoverished as it looks from outside.
Wow, great. Let me just ask you two really quick questions, not really quick questions, but two important sort of hands-on questions. Now, this goes to an international audience. I mean, it goes all over the planet in English, and then it gets translated into other languages. So there are people of various socioeconomic levels and levels of, you know, intellectual sophistication, et cetera. What would you say, this is sort of a two-part question, what can you say to anybody where they, to help them come to a more, say, peaceful attitude toward somebody they know in their lives who are dying? In other words, somebody who, for example, doesn't have a lot of experience with meditation or those kind of things. Is there something you can say that can hook people in that they'll be able to somehow come more consciously to their next death episode, whether it's within themselves or with someone that they love?
I would invite them to first of all, stay very close to their truth. I would invite a person that is with a friend that's dying or with somebody there, the beloved that's dying, to stay close to their truth, which has in it incredible grief at the loss of this, the form of this person. And at the same moment to let the silent spaces between the conversation connect them to the depth of the connection to this other being, which really transcends form. I mean, there is a statement that love transcends death, and I find that to be absolutely true. That when you have connected to another human being in the deepest love, that after the person dies and you go through all your grieving for the form and the missing of the fun and the love and the intimacy, the kind of loving relationship, and you quiet down for a moment, you realize that the way in which you knew that person, in essence, is still present, and it didn't go anywhere. And a great saint in India, he was dying, and his devotee said, "Don't leave us, don't leave us." And he looked confused. He said, "Don't be silly. Where could I go? Mm-hmm. I'm just leaving my body. It's like I'm selling the Ford. I'm not going anywhere." And so I would invite people to play with the silence and not be afraid. When you're sitting holding the hand of somebody, or you're just alone feeling the pain, instead of just rehearsing the pain, start to sit with a flower or a candle or a stone or a sunset and just realize the vastness of the dance of life and death and nature and forces beyond your wildest dreams, and let yourself open into deeper and deeper spaces where you see that the life of a being is but a momentary thing, and it comes and goes, and yet there is some vast way in which we are all connected in such a profound and loving way.
Well, that's great. I want to ask you a question that I asked Stephen Levine, and again, forgive me if I sound like I'm resisting what you're saying. I'm not.
No, I don't think you are.
Okay. The problem that I sometimes have when I hear what you're saying and what Stephen Levine is saying is, on the one hand, we're in the face of a great mystery with death, but it seems like what you're talking about, sort of, you know, dying into this larger sense of things, it almost undercuts the profundity of it, because it's not really death. I mean, it's kind of okay. I mean, in a way, for me to really catch my breath about death and really open my eyes to what it is, it has to really be death. You know what I mean? But it sounds like you're saying it isn't, in a way.
Well, I think that that's the beautiful paradox, it is and it isn't. Because to the extent that you are on the plane of your consciousness, where you define what you experience through your senses as real, and everything else is not real, then the change of the loss of this phenomenon, this form, is real, and it's profound, and it's deep, and it's ripping. To the extent you are in that part of your consciousness that is not attached to form, but to essence, then it really is just a change in form. You just see it as phenomena changing, and you're not really feeling, it isn't profound, it's just another moment. I mean, from a larger sense, from the soul's point of view, the death of the body is just, it's why in India they call it the dropping of the body. And they say, who dropped the body? Because if you think you're your body, it couldn't drop itself, something drops it. And then you have a sense that there is a continuity of consciousness, and especially in those parts of the world which are vast, where people have a sense of continuity, like with the term reincarnation. What is one more birth and death? And so you're not trivializing it, but you're putting it in a context which makes it more like ending a chapter of a book before you start the next chapter.
So it's just a hiatus, really. It's just a moment.
Yeah, it's just, it's another moment. And if you get into your own mind, you begin to see that when your meditation practice gets deep, you will see that from moment to moment, the universe is sort of dying and being reborn, and dying and being reborn. And in a way, you're going through that all the time. But what you're doing is your mind is, it's just like when you're looking at movie film, it's going at 28 frames or whatever that is, that's giving you a feeling of continuity. But each frame is discrete, and there's a space between each frame. And that space is really the death and the rebirth, actually, right at that moment. And it gives you the illusion that it's a continuous process. But actually, it's arising, existing, passing away, arising, existing, passing away, arising, existing. And when your mind gets very subtle, you actually see your own mind doing that.
It must be quite a recognition.
It's a profound recognition, because then you understand what in Buddhism, for example, spoken about anicca, the nature of changing phenomena, that everything is impermanent. Everything in the universe is impermanent, and that means bodies, and it means every metal and every star and all of it is all changing continually, and there is no place you can hold in form that is not going to change. It may take a while, but it'll change.
It's interesting that you're sort of maybe I'm getting a little esoteric here, but it's talking about the sort of the binary nature of the universe, but at the same time, there's a sort of non-linear mandal of it all, where it isn't changing at all. It just is.
That's if you get back far enough and you don't focus on any form. So you say things change. Nothing doesn't change.
Right.
So since all things arise out of no thing, which is God, which has no name, which is beyond name, which is not conceptual, however you want to say it, I would say God doesn't change. Or awareness is. Paramatman or Brahma. Brahma is eternal. And you can go from system to system and find the way they use a word to describe that which is not a word. The finger pointing at the thing that's beyond the finger. And what you say is that source has no change in it because it has no form. The minute it comes into form, it's all changing.
It's a very delicate dance, isn't it?
Isn't it? And we exist both in form and not in form. And that's the exciting thing about a human condition, that we can awaken to the fullness of that, it's so easy to define ourselves only in the forms that we can smell, taste, touch, see, hear, but to awaken to that part of us which is not form, and even the word that part is, of course, not the right thing, because that implies form. So, but that's the mystery. That's when you play with the mystery inside your own mind. And when you get that balance, so you realize the incredible depth of us, then you can dance in form without being trapped in it.
It's amazing because the responsibility of how it is for you rests with you. Like the old Jewish Midrash, which says that the manna that came from heaven tasted like what you wanted it to taste like.
Exactly right.
Which, it's very scary, but the fact that there's manna there in the first place means the whole thing is predicated on a mercy and something that's very beautiful. Are you
exactly, and that's when you realize that, for example, God is always there. It's just you that doesn't allow it in. The grace is always present. The living spirit, the non-form, is always surrounding you, but your mind is somehow so entrenched that it just doesn't allow it in.
Are you comfortable enough from all the spiritual work that you've done with the prospect of your own death? I mean, how do you feel? Do you feel that, you know, when you get a prognosis someday, maybe 120 years, that you'll be able to really hold on to this? Do you feel
that? No, how would I know? I mean, I can say at this moment, I feel quite comfortable with it all. I don't know what it'll be like when it actually comes. I don't know how prepared I will be. I'm working on it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I've been through enough experiences that are where my habitual mind has been ripped to shreds. And I found that I'm quite present in those situations and seem to not be caught in my fear of dissolving my identity, the surrender that's required. But I don't know how I'll be.
I'm thinking of Tim, who's an old family friend now. We're very dear friends with Rosemary Leary. You probably know her, remember
yes,
her.
Yes, quite well.
And it's interesting because he had so much sort of anti-death talk. It was sort of cosmically uncool even to contemplate mortality because it was all about, and now how he's sort of risen to the occasion with his own diagnosis.
Well, he has and he hasn't. I was with him about 2 weeks ago. I see him quite often now, or frequently. And if you scratch the surface of that, it's more like a theater piece rather than a depth thing.
Well, that's always been his predicament.
It's always been his predicament, exactly. And now I think it's really, because I go down really to, I mean, I don't go down as Mr. Death, but I go down, you know, and I said to him, Tim, I just want you to know that if you would feel comfortable, but I'd love to be with you when you die. And I'll make every effort to do that if you ask. And, but as I go near the topic, I can see that it's really, he's looking at it from outside in just at this moment still.
Well,
because he has invested so much in the material universe, the universe of his own thought.
And biology.
And that it's very hard for him to now make a leap into something he's rejected so long.